mission beats a Hollywood movie project starring Tom Cruise. The mission adds to a long list of firsts for Russia's space industry. Fabric cuts used to recreate Vietnamese landscapes. A woman living in the capital, Hanoi, has been doing that for 40 years now. The artist, 61 years old, explains what material she uses to create her artworks.
All the details in my artworks are cut from cloth, which is used for oyai, traditional costume, or cut from silk scarves. These are very small details, and I have to get the whole cloth for oyai. I even have to cut them from beautiful silk scarves sent from my friends abroad.
Took says sometimes hundreds of thousands of pieces of cloth are needed to shape the scenes. The cuts should be put together very carefully. Besides that, the woman has to work in a room without any air conditioning, even in the boiling summers of Hanoi. That's because, she says, the pieces of cloth are very tiny and would easily be blown away. Her hard work has paid off. The creations sell for up to $5,000. The Vietnamese artist says her work are a summary of the passion and the beauty she has experienced after traveling across her country.
Materials and methods are vital for an artist who combines them to create a masterpiece. Well, a Brazilian artist has used an unusual material to create a huge, dazzling artwork. Mandano has drawn a mural measuring 1,000 square meters using ashes from the burned Amazon rainforest. The artwork on the side of a building in the city of Sao Paulo depicts a firefighter standing near the scenes of deforestation, blazes, and dead animals. Mandano says he traveled extensively to feel that sadness and, more importantly, to collect ashes for his paintings. He says his aim is to call attention to the environment in his home country, where thousands of wildfires break out each year.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
According to the Financial Times, the thousands of pages of leaked documents paint a damaging picture of a company that has prioritized growth over other concerns. And the Washington Post concluded that the choices made by founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg, as detailed in the revelations, led to disastrous outcomes for the social media giant and its users. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by John Quilley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Profits Before People. The Facebook Papers Expose Tech Giant Greed. Stay tuned for more. Internal documents, the Facebook Papers, were published widely by an international consortium of news outlets who jointly obtained the redacted materials recently made available to the U.S. Congress by company whistleblowers. Voice of Blur, Francis Hogan. The papers were shared among 17 U.S. outlets as well as a separate group of news agencies in Europe, with all the journalists involved sharing the same publication date but performing their own reporting based on the documents. According to the Financial Times, the thousands of pages of leaked documents paint a damaging picture of a company that has prioritized growth over other concerns. And the Washington Post concluded that the choices made by the founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg, as detailed in the revelations, led to disastrous outcomes for the social media giant and its users. From an overview of the documents and the reporting project by the Associated Press, the papers themselves are redacted versions of disclosures that Hogan has made over several months to the Securities and Exchange Commission, alleging Facebook was prioritizing profits over safety and hiding its own research from investors and the public. These complaints cover a range of topics, from its efforts to continue growing its audience to how its platforms might harm children, to its alleged role in inciting political violence. The same redacted versions of those filings are being provided to members of Congress as part of its investigation. And that process continues as Hogan's legal team goes through the process of redacting the CEE filings by removing the names of Facebook users and lower-level employees and turns them over to Congress. One key revelation highlighted by the Financial Times is that Facebook has been perplexed by its own algorithms, and another was that the company fiddled while the Capitol burned during the January 6th insurrection staged by loyalists to former President Donald Trump trying to hold the certification of last year's election. CNN warned that the totality of what's contained in the documents may be the biggest crisis in the company's history. But critics have long said that at the heart of the company's problem is the business model upon which it was built and the mentality that governs it from the top, namely Zuckerberg himself. Recently, following reporting based on a second former employee of the company coming forward after Hogan, Free Press Action's CEO Jessica J. Gonzalez said, "The latest whistleblower revelations confirm that many of us have been sounding the alarm about for years. Facebook is not fit to govern itself," said Gonzalez. "The social media giant is already trying to minimize the value and impact of these whistleblower exposés, including Francis Hogan's. The information these brave individuals have brought forth is of immense importance to the public, and we are grateful that these and other truth-tellers are stepping up," unquote. While Zuckerberg has testified multiple times before Congress, Gonzalez said nothing has changed. "It's time for Congress and the Biden administration to investigate a Facebook business model that profits from spreading the most extreme hate and disinformation," she said. "It's time for immediate action to hold the company accountable for the many harms it's inflicted on our democracy," unquote. With Hogan set to testify before the UK Parliament, activists in London staged protests against Facebook and Zuckerberg, making clear that the giant social media company should be seen as a global problem. Flora Robello Ardini, senior campaigner with the Corporate Accountability Group, was part of a team that erected a large cardboard display of Zuckerberg surfing a wave of cash outside of Parliament with a flag that read, "I know we harm kids, but I don't care." A rip on a video Zuckerberg posted of himself earlier this year, right riding a hydrofoil while holding an American flag. While Zuckerberg refused an invitation to testify in the UK about the company's activities, including the way it manipulates and potentially harms young users on the platform, critics like Ardini said the giant tech company must be held to account. Kids don't stand a chance against the multi-billion dollar Facebook machine primed to feed them contempt that causes severe harm to mental and physical well-being, she said. This industry is rotten at its core, and the clearest proof of that is what's doing to our children. Lawmakers must urgently step in and pull the tech giants into line. Right now, Mark Zuckerberg is unaccountable, Hogan told The Guardian in an interview ahead of her testimony, adding, he has all the control, he has no oversight, and he has not demonstrated that he is willing to govern the company at the level that is necessary for public safety.
Profit. Man was created on the morning of the sixth day. The time of worship commenced. And Adam began the rituals for his Lord. He, and after him, his progeny, performed such rituals. Religions appeared one after another. All of them represented one God, one path, one origin, and one end to mankind. Every messenger who was appointed by God to convey his message informed the people of the advent of the last prophet of God. In this sense, Buddha and Krishna said the very same thing which Noah, Abraham, Moses, John, Zoroaster, and Jesus said. One told the name of the final prophet, and the other spoke of his origin. One forecast the signs of his homeland, while the other described the characteristics of his language. In one way or another, each prophet informed mankind of the joyous news of the advent of the final prophet, the last messenger of the heavens. In the very beginning of history, God sent Adam, his first prophet on earth, to propagate and show the heavenly path to the inhabitants of this world. Thousands of years have passed ever since, and some people continue to follow him by residing exclusively near the riverbanks of the world. Zoroastrianism is one of the most ancient religions of the world. These days, most of its followers are found in Iran, India, and some regions of Central Asia. They possess a heritage several thousand years old. Like the prophets before him, Zoroaster also informed his followers of the coming of divine prophets. The religious scripts of Zoroastrianism refer to these messengers as Sotians. There are three Sotians who were foretold to appear after the Zoroaster. All Alternatively, three sociants, three beneficent personalities, will come one after the other. Throughout history, the followers of Zoroaster have been waiting for their arrival. They have searched for them everywhere.
Attilo! What brings you here?
They are visitors from the east. Follow the star. The star of the prophecy.
The prophecy of the Messiah?
So far, only three Zoroastrian sages have succeeded in seeing the first sociant in Bethlehem. When the last prophet of God appeared in Hejaz, there were many Zoroastrians who saw the signs of the second sociant in him. They joined him in large numbers and became his followers and helpers. However, there are still many Zoroastrians who are keenly waiting for the arrival of the third sociant. They hope that this universal reformer will appear and make the world a utopia. In India, the land of many creeds, there are several mysterious religions spread out in the vast jungles and mountainous regions. Here, you find religions such as Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, and Sikhism. Though, in some case, the followers of these religions have become deviated from the right path. The depth of meaning and spirituality that these religions reveal is indicative of man's inherent tendency to establish a close relationship with an infallible creator and worship him. Historical roots of Hinduism are spread over thousands of years. Mysterious ascetics with wonderful conducts live all over India, in colorful shrines and dark temples in legendary jungles. They make the unspeakable things of this mysterious land even more mysterious.
God is one only. Even in India, in the Hindu philosophy, God is always one. But his manifestation is many.
This historical religion has several holy books as guidelines for its followers. These books are full of strange and unsaid mysteries. Among the sacred books of Hindus are the Puranas. These ancient books contain the history of the universe, the genealogy of kings and heroes, and the foretelling of future events. In these books, we again witness indications of the coming of a spiritual teacher called Muhammad from a foreign land. What Raja Bhuj respectfully says, "I prostrate myself before you, O you, the pride of mankind. of Arabia, you have gathered a great power to eradicate Satan.
In one of the Puranas in India, Bhavishya Purana, it is also mentioned that Mahamud, Paigambar Muhammad, will be born in the Middle East and he would cleanse the people of corruption and bad habits there, and you know, he will bring a new wave of devotion. This is mentioned thousands of years ago in the Hindu texts, in a Purana. One verse is there, one quote is there that such and such a person, a prediction was done about that.
He will appear in a sandy desert in the land of Arabia. He will be known as the pride of humanity, and his name is Muhammad. What could be the secret that has been also mentioned in the holy books of Hindus, and of which the Hindu monks have spoken? The history of Jainism goes back about 600 years before the appearance of Christ. According to Jainism, salvation can only be achieved through the practice of asceticism. The tenets of this faith dictate that God has 24 avatars on earth. The last one of them will be born in a peninsula, and the name of his father is Vishnu Bhagat, which is the equivalent of Abdullah. And the name of his mother is Somanib, which is the equivalent of Amina. He is said to be taught by Bhagwan in a cave. Sikhs, who wear a unique turban on their head, are followers of another religion in India. But are there any hints about the holy prophet of Islam and his religion in the scriptures of Sikhs? To the promise made thousands of years ago by Eastern religions concerning the advent of a prophet called Muhammad in Arabia, Abrahamic religions also foretell the arrival of a great prophet on earth in the last age of humanity. Moses and Jesus endured many difficulties on the path of propagating their messages. They promised the people about the advent of a man from among the descendants of Abraham. The New Testament clearly promises the arrival of a prophet after Christ. An example of this can be seen in the Gospel of John. Shortly before the advent of Christ, Roman oppression was continuously increasing. More and more innocent people were crucified every day, and the poor were made even poorer through forced taxes. In such conditions, a man called John, from the shores of the Jordanian River, claimed prophecy. He kindled both doubt and hope in the hearts of the Jews of his time. Perhaps they wondered whether he was Messiah, the prophet foretold to end pain and tragedy. On the same day, Jewish leaders sent a group of Levites to John to investigate the matter.
Who are you?
John confessed. He did not deny. He answered,
I am not the Messiah.
Who are you then?
Are you Elijah?
No, I'm not.
Are you the prophet?
No.
Then tell us who you are.
We have to take an answer back to those who sent us.
When Prophet John replied that he was not Messiah, Elijah, or the promised prophet. The delegates, who were considering the new prophet to be one of these three, asked him in wonder,
"If you're not the Messiah, nor Elijah, nor the prophet, why do you baptize?"
"I baptize with water, but among you stands the one you do not know. He is coming after me, but I'm not good enough even to untie his sandals."
John's Gospel contains a marvelous secret within it. This secret, which reveals itself exclusively to those possessing wisdom and intellect, promises the advent of another prophet after Jesus. It speaks of a messenger for whom everyone is waiting. When Christ embarked upon his three-year-long mission, a great disagreement occurred among people.
"Whoever believes in me should drink. As the scripture says, streams of life-giving water will pour out from his side." "This man is really the prophet. The Messiah will not come from Galilee."
Many people said that he was the Messiah promised by the Bible. However, others did not agree to this and said that perhaps he was the foretold prophet. What we can understand from John's Gospel is that apart from Elijah, two other people must also come to mankind. One is the Messiah, and the other is, for the lack of a better title, the prophet. But where is the prophet, who according to John's Gospel must come, and has yet to come?
All the Christianity believe in the genuineness of Prophet Muhammad. I mean, believe that he was a prophet or not.
I do not know for all of Christianity. I have no doubt. I have no doubt myself. He is a prophet, and spoke the word of God with great love and kindness and beauty.
Yes,
the prophet is a symbol. The prophet is a human being, not God. He's a human being that he had great faith, a maximum of the faith. And he was in contact with God when he was alive. And he passed the messages of God to the people.
Will Durant writes, "According to the documents discovered on the shores of the Dead Sea, people were awaiting the foretold prophet, whose appearance, along with that of the Messiah, was promised. But who is this prophet, and from where does he originate? In order to answer this question, we will have to go back and investigate his characteristics as found in the Old Testament. According to the Old Testament, Moses saved the children of Israel from the Egyptians' bondage and made them cross the sea. He guided them during the course of 40 years of wandering in the Sinai Desert until they reached the banks of the Jordanian River. The Israelites continued their lives as nomads. For this reason, Moses gathered them all and said, 'God told me, I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren like unto thee, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all, that I shall command him, and it shall come to pass, that whosoever will not hearken unto my words, which he shall speak in my name, I will require it of him.' The Bible only recognizes the children of Ishmael as the brethren of the Israelites. Hence, the foretold prophet must have been raised among the brethren of the Israelites. He must have been given a book like that of Moses, and he must have come with a religious law like that of Moses. The question stands, to which prophet can all these qualities be attributed? Pre priest James Dow writes in the Collins Dictionary of the Bible, "The only personality for whom the forecast of Torah can fit is Muhammad, because he is the only person who resembles Moses and has a book and a religious law." The prophets came one after the other and guided humanity towards the truth. Every prophet promised his followers about the advent of the last messenger of God, Muhammad, about whom the Puranas had promised, the second sociant of the Zoroastrians, a prophet from Arabia, the last avatar riding on a horse, the prophet resembling Moses and the descendant of the brethren of the Israelites, and the prophet mentioned in John's Gospel. Who is he? In which land was he raised? In which era did he render as true the promise of all the prophets before him? After centuries of denial and defiance by the unbelievers, Muhammad, the son of Abdullah, titled as Ahmad, the seal of all prophets, from the house of Ishmael, appeared in the land of the Arabs to guide mankind, so that man may not remain in the darkness of ignorance. And now, on the threshold of another millennium, man continues the path of his predecessors in the persecution of the propagators of the message of God, those who decapitated Prophet John, put the cross on the shoulders of Christ, and mounted the Crusades, are once again continuing with their blasphemous persecution of the last prophet of God. They fed their ancient grudge. They despised the sacred. And driven to despair, they set fire to the truth and tried desperately to injure the prophet.
There is no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. There is no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish. Thank you.
says countries must strengthen climate ambitions after wasting chance to build back better after COVID-19 pandemic. We now present you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, UN Warns World Faces Disastrous 2.7 Degrees Celsius Temperature Rise on Current Climate Plans. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to a report from the United Nations, the world is squandering the opportunity to build back better from the COVID-19 pandemic and faces disastrous temperature rises of at least 2.7 degrees Celsius if countries fail to strengthen their climate pledges. On Tuesday, 26th of October, the report was published warning that countries' current pledges would reduce carbon by only about 7.5%. by 2030, far less than the 45% cut scientists say is needed to limit global temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius. The aim of the COP26 summit that opens in Glasgow, Scotland, this Sunday, 31st of October. Antonio Guterres, the United Nations Secretary General, described the findings as a thundering wake-up call to world leaders, while experts called for drastic action against fossil fuel companies. According to the United Nations Emissions Report, which examines the shortfall between countries' intentions and actions needed on the climate, although more than 100 countries have promised to reach net zero emissions around mid-century, this would not be enough to stave off climate disaster. Many of the net zero pledges were found to be vague, and unless accompanied by stringent cuts in emissions this decade, would allow global heating of a potentially catastrophic extent. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, "The heat is on, and as the contents of this report show, the leadership we need is off, far off. Countries are squandering a massive opportunity to invest COVID-19 fiscal and recovery resources in sustainable, cost-saving, planet-saving ways." As world leaders prepare for the COP26 conference in Glasgow, this report is another thundering wake-up call. How many do we need? Inge Andersen, the Executive Director of the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, which produced the report, said, "Climate change is no longer a future problem. It is a now problem. To stand a chance of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, we have 8 years to almost halve greenhouse gas emissions. 8 years to make the plans, put in place the policies, implement them, and ultimately deliver the cuts. The clock is ticking loudly." United Nations report found emissions fell by about 5.4% last year during COVID lockdowns, but only about a fifth of the spending on economic recovery was geared to efforts that would cut carbon. The United Nations said this failure to build back better, despite promises by governments around the world, cast doubt on the world's willingness to make the economic shift necessary to tackle the climate crisis. In the run-up to COP26, countries were supposed to submit national plans on emission cuts, called Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, for the next decade, a requirement under the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. But the United Nations Environment Programme report found only half of countries had submitted new NDCs, or Nationally Determined Contributions, with big emitters still to publish their plans, and several governments, including Brazil, Australia, and Mexico, had presented weak plans that were no improvement on their 2015 Paris pledges. Joanna Depledge of the Cambridge Centre for Environment, Energy and Natural Resource Governance said, "The picture painted by the report is grim. Less than half of the nationally determined contributions, or NDCs, are genuinely more ambitious than the first round submitted in 2015 or 2016. Joanna Depledge added, "There is an ambition gap between country pledges and the cuts needed to limit temperature rise. And even more troubling is an implementation gap. Many large emitters are not even on track to meet their existing pledges." According to the report, which took into account pledges made before the end of September, longer-term net zero pledges for mid-century have now been adopted by 49 countries as well as the European Union, putting about half of global emissions, half of GDP, and about a third of the global population under net zero pledges. But Inga Andersson says net zero promises from governments were often vague or ambiguous. She said if these could be made robust and implemented fully, the world could have half a degree Celsius off the projected warming of 2.5 degrees Celsius that the United Nations Environment Programme has predicted. Yoeri Rogel, the Director of Research at Grantham Institute, Imperial College London, says if implemented, current net zero targets would lower temperature projections for the next century by about half a degree Celsius, bringing central estimates close to 2 degrees Celsius, yet still not in line with holding global warming well below 2 degrees Celsius, let alone 1.5 degrees Celsius. Yoeri Rogel says, on the other hand, the report also highlights that in many cases, countries' near-term targets are not yet putting emissions a clear track towards achieving their net zero goals. This casts doubt on whether these targets will ever be achieved. Ed Miliband, Britain's shadow business secretary, says it's time for the government to start telling the truth about how far away we are from where we need to be in this decisive decade. This report makes clear there can be no shifting of the goalposts from action this decade to targets in the middle of this century. If we follow this course, we will fail to keep global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius and betray future generations. Ed Miliband added, "The window of action is closing, and it is critical that in the budget and the days ahead, the Prime Minister and the government step up to make COP26 the summit of climate delivery, not climate delay." The emissions gap report also highlighted methane, a powerful greenhouse gas that arises from animal husbandry, natural gas extraction, and waste. The United States and the European Union and more than 20 other countries have signed a pledge to reduce methane emissions globally by 30% this decade. The United Nations Environment Programme says methane was the second biggest contributor to temperature rises after carbon, and that about 20% of annual methane emissions could be cut at little or no cost, for instance, through better management of natural gas drilling, stopping flaring and capping old wells. Miles Allen, a professor of geosystems science at University of Oxford in England, has championed the idea of forcing fossil fuel companies and other big emitters to pay for the permanent storage of the carbon they emit through a carbon take-back obligation using carbon capture and storage technology. Miles Allen said, "On current progress, we'll close the 2030 emissions gap sometime in the 2080s. There is no appetite for reducing fossil fuel consumption globally at the rate required. The only remaining option is to scale up safe and permanent disposal of carbon dioxide, so storing it back underground instead of fly-tipping it into the atmosphere.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Maribor Uprisings, directed by Michael Raza and Milton Gillen. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him is Marisa Cloud, who is a social commentator and director of Media Diversified. He is also the vice chair of social policy research organization Race on the Agenda. Now, the Maribor Uprising shows how in the once prosperous industrial city of Maribor, which is Slovenia's second largest city, anger over political corruption turned into a revolt against the mayor, the violent police forces, and the corrupt political elite. This documentary places audiences in the midst of the uprising as crowds surround and ransack the city hall under a hailstorm of tear gas canisters. The Maribor Uprisings raises many questions faced by these events and by the uprisings elsewhere, from the Arab Spring through Paris to Black Lives Matter.
When we watched the images from the protests of the Arab Spring, Greece and Occupy, we were certain that nothing like that could happen here. That is, until they installed the new stationary radar system which sent speeding tickets right to your home, 70,000 in the first weeks of operation. Then we found out that 90% of the proceeds went to a private contractor, not to our city. Then we learned the mayor had close ties to the private contractor. Then we heard he was running for the National Council, which would give him immunity from prosecution. Then we heard where this was happening, and we went there to stop it. Twice we went into the streets. Twice the police drove us away. Twice the news media embedded behind police lines portrayed us all as hooligans and criminals.
We formed a video collective because things looked very different on our side of the police lines. All the footage in this documentary is shot by people like me, people like you. I invite you to join us as we record a new uprising, the third uprising, organized on Facebook and called for tonight. You'll decide how you participate.
Will you stay here and film with the people fighting to hold the square? Or do you go to record those who are seeking safety further to the south?
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So we're in this show, we're reviewing the theatrical version of the documentary. It was initially screened as an interactive film, which gave the audience a chance to make decisions throughout the film. And Mike, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, there are two different versions of this film, and I think the version that we saw is an imperfect version in that, you know, it has the rough edges that I would associate with activist and collective derived filmmaking, the rough edges that I think the filmmakers would say authenticizes that the action.
Would you say that by the style of the filmmaking?
Yeah.
And that with smartphones and
exactly, yeah. It's shot on the fly, and you know, there's no sort of calculated camera movements, any of the sort of slickness that you would get with more commercially minded documentary, I think. There's something missing in terms of what we actually get, in terms of what the protesters are protesting against, I think. We get mentioned mentioned very early on a certain amount of public money being spent on radar systems. Beyond that, there's a kind of generalized dissatisfaction and rumbling with the administration. So maybe that was all addressed in the interactive version. We didn't get that. What it has, and what really is its strength, is the sense of absolutely being caught up in the middle of something, and in the middle of something that I think is sort of quite localized. We've seen a lot of films about protest movements in the last few years, things like We Are Many, about the Iraq War, the protests against that, The Square, about the Arab Spring, Maidan in Ukraine, but they're all big epic movies. This is much more localized. It feels like the kind of protest that you and your friends could organize, or that you and your friends could, you know, rock up to on a Saturday afternoon and participate in, and that's a strength of the film, I think.
So do you think this film serves as a valuable tool for audiences who haven't experienced the protest firsthand?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the reasons why it exists in several forms. It's a very good point of entry, I think, for people who haven't necessarily been on many protests and maybe coming to a protest for the first time, but do feel they have got something to say and something to share. And it shows you all the avenues you can go down in the course of one afternoon or one evening's protest.
And Marie, sorry, if I could turn to you now. As someone who advocates for racial equality and justice, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I found it interesting. Like you say, that it was very bitty, but that's its nature and that's how it should be. It very much felt like you were in the protest, and I thought we didn't get the full interactive side of things, but that really felt like you were making decisions and you were in amongst it. There were bits, like you say, there were bits missing for me. I would like to have known a little bit more. I think if it were made commercially or whatever, there'd been a bit more about the history, a bit more about how they got into that situation. And yes, you understood that there was corruption and that people were feeling aggrieved, but I thought there could have been a little bit more to show how they were to how they ended up in the protest, because one of the big points they made was that people didn't expect the police to behave so violently, that it was a prosperous city and people were kind of used to it since 1991, at the end of Yugoslavia, they'd had their independence and freedom, they felt very empowered, and suddenly, maybe not suddenly, but as the corruption became more and more obvious, the protests grew and ended up pretty violent. I thought that was gathered quite well. So you felt very much like, well, why is this happening? And but maybe with a bit more background from before, you would have got that a bit more. I felt like that was missing a little bit. It's sort of, you were right, you're plonked right into the middle of it. And it's like, okay,
you're figuring things out for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That
totally.
Was intentional.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Which I guess, if it were a real protest, that's exactly what happens. You're like, well, do I want to go down there?
There's a lot of moral questions, and there's lots to grapple with. And I think perhaps the abstract and philosophical nature of the documentary is a credit to it, and that's the kind of questions it raises. So we really get the sense of desperation and the sense of urgency for their need and want for change in the country. And we also get the sense that nothing has changed for a really long time, and even suggests that something more radical needs to be done. Mike, I know Maurice mentioned that there isn't a lot of political context, but is there something, there's a need for these people to drive out to the streets?
Yes, I mean, very early on there's a quote where one of the protesters says, we detected this growing chasm between what we want and what the world around us is. And so the entire film becomes a sort of disquisition into, well, how do you fix that gap? How do you bridge that gap? And one of the ways is to look around at the people around you, and they start looking out to one another and making their own images. Now, the protests that we see here come at a very crucial time in Maribor's history. We learned that they've just been named European City of Culture. It's often the case that these big moments tend to sort of focus a lot of energy in this way. I was thinking sort of the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. There was a lot of unrest before that. There were protests before the 2016 Olympics in Rio. What we're dealing with here is a contrast between the official version of events, the image that the authorities want to show to the world, and what the people actually on the street are seeing in their day-to-day reality. And one of the ways you bridge that gap is by making your own images. And this is exactly, I think, what this film is doing. It's showing you the images, the reality, as seen by people on the streets who just weren't happy with the image the authorities were projecting outwards to the world.
And Maurice, would you agree with what Mike said?
Absolutely.
Do you think there's universal aspects to this protest?
I think they're very universal aspects to the protest. I would add to what you were saying, in that this was the third protest, and as they said in the trailer, the other two protests had been, filmed by the the standard media, and they felt that they weren't representing what was actually going on. So people took control and made their own media. That's great. That's the way forward. And the universality of that is that's what happens now in protest. It's no longer is it. Well, let's see what the BBC are saying about our protest. People get on and do it themselves, and we have the ability now to do that. Maybe not as joined up as a documentary like this, but most protests now, if I were watching a protest, I would go online and I'd watch someone who was there, and I rather than watching the sanitized version, or the version that we know is spun to some extent. So there's a lot in that. There's a lot in let's get our own message across. Let's film our own stuff. Let's show our own images and tell our own stories. That's universal, and that's certainly came across.
Well, that's a really good point.
I knew that people went into the streets in Cairo, Athens, Paris, and Ferguson for such different reasons. But when I watch their footage, it still reminds me of our experience. I mean, in each city, it was the reaction of the police that turned protests into uprisings.
And Mike, what can you tell us about the way the police are portrayed?
Well, it, for all the sort of rough edges of it, in many ways, it's a very classical three-act narrative. So the first act is getting people out on the streets. The second act is what then happens once all these people are out on the streets. How do you control that mass of people? And there's very early on a fear amongst the protesters that there might be some kind of violent action. I was surprised, actually, that there are one or two clips where you actually see the policemen liaising with the protesters and coming over to the protesters and saying, can you just tone it down a bit? Which, I think if a film was determined to demonize the police force, they wouldn't have those little clips in. But at the same time, we do see a good deal of violent action like that. And as the narrative says, these are the actions that turn a protest into an uprising and have this sort of violent reaction. So I think it achieves a balance. You do get a sense of, the immense amount of fear on both sides, I think, once huge amounts of people take to the streets.
Mm-hmm. And I was getting this impression that the filmmakers had a sense of betrayal and shock by the police force. They expected them to be the people's protector, but then they suddenly turned on them and suppressed their voices. What did you make of this?
Yeah, there was a very specific moment, wasn't it, where the narrator said that they came under attack, and it surprised them that they reacted exactly the same as the other protested and started defending themselves. And she talks about love and the barricades, and you look at the person next to you, if they, you're being pelted with tear gas or whatever, and they pick up a tear gas and throw it back, it's a very natural thing. You feel very connected to the people next to you, and that really came across. It didn't feel at all, I don't think it needs to, it didn't feel like an objective view of what was going on. It was like, this is from inside, this is what we're seeing. That really came across, I felt. But yeah, the police violence, as a lot of the people interviewed said, that's what really made this into a major protest. Because it sounded like people were kind of disgruntled and were cross with the mayor, and then the police reacted in a very strong way, which shocked everyone, which made a counter reaction, which is often the case, isn't it? It's often, look at Catalonia or something, it's often the case that the way your authorities deal with what could be, perfectly reasonable protest ends up sparking something quite bigger.
So we see this in lots of protests, Mass versus Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, etc. Mike, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a visual contrast in the film as well, because we're getting lots of different opinions from the protesters. They're a very diverse lot, whereas when we see the police, they're all there dressed alike, they're all in uniform, they're all lined up together, moving forward silently. They become this kind of anonymous.